Please help me welcome our speaker tonight, which is Karen from Asbury Park, New Jersey. She's a member of the Design for Living group in Neptune, New Jersey. Karen.
Hey, thank you so much. My name is Karen. I'm an alcoholic.
Hi, Karen.
I appreciate the opportunity to come out and visit you. I love this. Our re-entry post-COVID to actually come out and see and feel and be with the energy of the recovery that I hold so dear to my heart. I have a sobriety date. It's September 6th, 1989. I have a home group. Right now it's Designed for Living in Neptune, New Jersey. It's a big book study group. A lot of the time, if you're ever in the area, meet Sunday nights at 7 o'clock, and we'd love to have you. Open, friendly opportunity to meet and greet people. The group just celebrated 17 years. They've done a lot of connecting down in Monmouth County, you know, and have brought the message of alcoholics to people like me. So that's there. I just recently did transfer myself down to Asbury Park during that pandemic. I lived in North Jersey, and shut up in North Jersey. I'm in a townhouse. I got a breeze. So I went to the beach. I did. I went to the beach, and I found a new way to be. And it's interesting. Sometimes you've got to be in a lot of pain before you get out of that chair, right? All right, so I'm going to tell you a little bit about what it was like, what I was like, you know, what happened, and what it's like today. I am from the Midwest. I was born in Chicago and raised in Wisconsin. I have a twin brother. We're the oldest of 7 kids, and my parents have both suffered from this disease, brutally suffered from this disease. Didn't know that's what it was. You know, as we moved around the state of Wisconsin growing up, and, you know, sometimes we'd move in the middle of the night with clothes on our back, you know, with all these kids in a sedan, and sometimes we'd move with a moving van. It's very confusing. You know, I went to 8 grammar schools and 4 high schools, and my brothers, I have 5 brothers and a sister, my brothers really became my buddies, and didn't really fit well into a town or a group because we always could leave. So it was there I learned how to wear that mask of whatever you wanted me to be, I'd be. Because I was leaving anyway. So who the heck cared, right? So, I always excelled. I was one of those A-type personalities and still am, as some people in this room can attest to, that I'm always like trying to be on the top of the heap so I can see. If I'm on the top, perhaps maybe you know won't catch me and lock me in the basement or whatever the stuff that was going on in my crazy untreated alcoholic home. And I know that today that's what it was. I didn't know it then. It was just terrorizing, and I didn't have any idea of what I was to encounter whenever we walked home. And so. What brought me out to live that way, I can tell you a little bit more about that. My dad grew up in Chicago. My mom in Detroit. My mom is the youngest of 4, and her dad was an engineer. He designed the Loop in Chicago, you know, a big, huge company in construction, and lost it all in the Depression and moved to Chicago, moved his family to Chicago. So my mom died when she was little, so she was kind of passed around to everybody. And she, like me, you know, loved to drink. You know, we make decisions when we love to drink based on self that set us up to be hurt again, but we don't know that that's what we're doing. Anyway, she met my dad along the line. My dad was a semi-pro basketball player and a high life, you know. And it's really interesting, you know, the guy Jim in our book reminds me of probably the charisma of my dad. You know, how we just can charm the life out of everybody, and did that. They got married and promptly had all these kids. But anyway, he was a salesman. Yeah, as I find, most alcoholics are really successful salespeople because we don't really cooperate with authority or something. But he was a salesman, traveled all over, and, you know, along with that lifestyle, you know, he was a womanizer, and we did a lot of changing, and alcohol was right behind the whole story. So you ended up in New Jersey when I was a senior in high school. And there I found my people and my lifestyle in New Jersey. You guys were so totally different on East than you were where I grew up. Good Catholic girl, I was wearing uniform, so I didn't know how to like be cool and wear clothes. I didn't know how to talk. I tried to hide my Midwestern twang so you won't know where I'm from. You know, all that kind of stuff, you know, just trying to play the game to be okay with, to be accepted. I refused to go to a Catholic school, so we went to first public school of my entire life, and I think I cried every single day, you know, trying to get in there. But on the way home one day, I took a different route, and, cause you never knew what you went home to in my house, so I took a different route, and I found the people under the bridge, and they introduced me to dry goods and the rest of the light, and I finally fit in. You know, therein was a whole nother story. It took me hold on another avenue. But I can tell you from the time I was a little kid, you know, when we would have these family gatherings down in the Chicago area with all of these cousins. Aunt has 9 kids, another uncle has 7, another one has 6. There's tons of kids and tons of chaos and tons of drinking and tons of untreated alcoholism. And we would go to my grandmother's house, and she lived on the south side of Chicago. And if you can picture the alleyways down there, the men would be in the garage playing poker, and that's where I'd be. You know, and I learned how to play poker, and I learned how to chug a beer, and I learned how to do a whole lot of stuff. I had no interest in the other stuff. And it all started there. I found that when I took that drink, it just did something inside so that I felt okay being around you. I didn't have any idea that I was this budding alcoholic. I had no idea. I knew you were. I know they were. They drank too much. But I had no idea that when I took that drink, that the drink was going to take me. And it took a while before it did that, before I crossed that line that we do at some point, where I realized that I was daily drinking and daily using, and I was always seeking to get high. Only that, so I could fit in, so I could breathe. It was very similar to being this experience I had with COVID reminded me very much of early recovery. Before I came here, I couldn't breathe. Couldn't take a breath, you know? So I was seek outside in. They talked about that. They taught me about that, the outside in. So I come out to New Jersey and, you know, I meet Mr. Wonderful. You know how that goes. And, you know, I was always really good in school. And like I said, I have a twin brother, and, it was Vietnam era, and there was drafting going on, and his number was 14. So, they paid for him to go to school. He was fourth. Let me see. He was 140th in our class. I was fourth. And so they said, well, you can just, you know, find something else to do. Why don't you go be a waitress? And you know, it was like, my first experience is like, somehow you think that if you do the deal and you do the deal that you won't be fired or you'll be hired or you'll be praised or, you know, if I just do what you tell me to do to succeed, that's not the story. You know, and anyway, he went to school and I went to school, but I didn't do it the way I thought I'd do. So it's always a matter of scheming, you know, getting my way and people telling us, that's not the way you do things, and I'd do it anyway, you know. I bowl in a china shop. So in New Jersey, I found a way up and out. I went up to school in Boston, met this guy, got married. Long story short, we snuffed the frickin' life out of each other. I had no idea that what I did to that guy, I don't look back. At the time, I could have told you everything is about him. At the time, I could have told you that it's his fault that I turned out that way. At the time, I would have told you that, but that is certainly not the truth. So I think I'm doing pretty good. You know, by this time, I'm drinking daily. I've been doing that since I got in high school. You know, it's my fourth high school, so who cares? I don't have any friends. You know, when you fill out those forms and they want to know, who is your favorite teacher? And I'm like, no idea. Or, where did you live in fourth grade? Or they'll tell you, who are your best friends? It's like, I can't answer any of those questions. You know, the geographics just don't permit that. Today I can. But then I can't answer that. And even I'll look at them and go, I wish I had a memory to tell you what had happened going back and forth with all that drinking and drugging and untreated alcoholism and abuse behind the door and all that stuff that goes on. And I wish my parents had a shot. They were introduced to Alcoholics Anonymous. My dad's uncle was part of the founding group in Chicago. Can you imagine? And Alcoholics Anonymous was brought to them, and they threw the big book at them. And I thought to myself, why'd you do that? We would have had a first edition in the family. But, you know, they were not interested in recovery like we see recovery. And I think about that, about the opportunities along the way, because we are who we are, and we think what we're doing is the best thing ever. You know, we got it all figured out. That there comes a time and a day and a place that suddenly happens in a different way that God talks, I listen. But I wasn't listening then, nor were they. But wonder what would happen on that road, how the choices we make create the life we have. And I wonder, because both my parents died from this disease, you know, as did many of my relatives. But, you know, heart attacks aren't far behind diabetes. You know, you just name it. It all comes along with untreated alcoholism. And the emotional stuff is really a mess. So fast forward, I'm back in New Jersey, meet this guy, get married. He has a fabulous opportunity. He's probably one of the smartest men I ever met in my life. And he gets a job on Wall Street, you know, doing his deal. And he's a trader, and I'm thinking that's an excellent career choice for him. Because he absolutely was. But, you know, we have the life. I have everything I ever thought made life important. You know, I had the house, I had the kids, I had the dog, I had the fence, this beautiful community in North Jersey. I had all that. I earned all the money you can possibly imagine. My kids' education was paid for when they were really young. And then the disease shows up. You know, and his part of the disease was drugs and gambling. And I'm drinking. And so we're not paying any attention to what either of us are doing. Other than in and out, comes and goes, he stays, he leaves, you know, all kind of stuff. And I'm terrorized now because my alcoholism is peaking. I don't know that's what it is. At a place where I gotta know where I have a drink hidden. And I became the mom I never said I would be. I'm meeting the school bus with, you know, a mug, coffee, Dunkin' Donuts, not coffee inside there. Or anything you can imagine. And I became the unpredictable that I swore I'd never be. I became that scary person behind the door that my kids would have to meet when they came home from school. I was the house that their friends weren't allowed to come to. You know, my husband's in and out. I think he was gone at this point for a couple of years. And he would do that. He would leave and go somewhere. And, you know, we would be surviving, hoping to be okay, and he'd reappear. And I kept thinking, you know, because there's always something about sex and checks, you know. We think we got it under control. I think I can manage this part of my life. And I was using pretty heavy then, and I just was so afraid that the voices that we hear, the messages that we're given, you're not good enough for that. You'll never amount to anything. You're inadequate. You're this, that. And you believe the story of the untreated alcoholic. Now, meantime, there are always angels in our path, right? There's always the grace of God has followed us everywhere to land us in the seat right here, right now, tonight. That grace was following me, and there are people who had never really called me out on my drinking or my thinking, which I absolutely deserve, but they would kind of redirect hope. And my grandmother was like that. So were some of these teachers that I had in grammar school and high school, that they would kind of like take you aside and say, you doing all right? And the kindness, the loving kindness kept winning. And I would hear messages of hope that what you're living in is not quite normal or something like that. But I was never brought. I was never arrested, although I should have been. I don't have a DUI. I should have one. All that stuff wasn't part of my story. Not to be part of my story. One day, it just became too much. You know, he had left again. I'd been doing everything, you know, waking up in places I shouldn't be waking up with people. I don't even know who they are. I had this thing when I was drinking about losing my car, my kids, and my groceries. you know, not really may not be that order. I probably had 5 sets of keys. You know, I never could remember what we were doing the night before. It would be a phone call like, where did we go? What did we do? You know, I didn't know that that was called a blackout. You know, and I still have them today. I cannot recall parts of my lifetime when I was using. I don't remember, and somebody will tell a story, and I said, was I even there? You know, so those blackouts and that alcohol, man, I'll tell you what. But the night before I got sober, I was out visiting my twin brother, and I had a van full of kids, you know, a minivan full of kids, and went out to his place, and we were drinking like crazy, as we always did. Because there's no stop for me at this point. I pick up a drink, the drink takes me till I'm done with the drink. That could be an afternoon, that could be one drink, or that could be days. I was so unpredictable. I never knew. So it's kind of prepared for the fact that you never knew what was going to show up. You kind of say, well, we might be staying here tonight or something, you know, to my kids and their friends or whatever. But I left that night and I drove back on Route 80, you know, this north highway that runs east and west up north. And I went down an exit ramp and there was a tractor trailer. I don't remember anything else. And I was home. I don't know how I got home. Nobody died, but I don't know how I got there. And it was the scariest moment to think that my precious cargo in my hands of a drunk mother could be dead. And I knew that was like the first clue that I had a problem drinking. This is a few days before I stopped. So there was a series of events that occurred. Now I'm going to look back. I know there are a series of events of God calling, you know. The next thing that happened is we went to a therapist recommended. Now, my dad by this time was an Alcoholics Anonymous. He told me that I really ought to consider coming out to Hazleton. That's when he got sober. Hazleton, because they have a program called ACOA, Adult Children Alcoholics. They don't call it that today. They call it ACA, I think. And I had been to a couple of those meetings, but they were just so mean talking about me that I had to go, you know. And Al-Anon was the same way. All I heard was the stuff I was doing that I was trying to keep secret that was bothering you, so I had to go. So I really was familiar, but that's it. I knew nothing about recovery. I thought an alcoholic was like my uncles or you were jobless. And I still had stuff. I hadn't lost everything yet. I still had all that. I wasn't in jail, so I couldn't associate alcoholic to me. I knew I drank too much, that's it. And this therapist was the first person ever that said to me, how much do you drink? And I said, what's the answer? Three, right? Three. No, I say three. Three, how many is three? And she said, I really think you ought to go check out Alcoholics Anonymous. And I went, what is that? I have no idea. I've never been to a detox. I've never been to rehab. I don't know that way. There's nobody in my family, really, because my dad had moved back to, part of the story, moved back to the Midwest with my mother's best friend. My mom tried to kill herself. You know, he takes the family, her 6 kids, the rest of my brothers, and they move back and they pretend they've always been married. It was crazy. But that's what they do. That's what you do to cover up the past that you don't want anyone to know about. You pretend it didn't exist or you change your name or you do something. That's what they did. And they left my sister and me behind and really excluded us from any of their... A couple times we went up, but we would look at each other like, did you hear what I heard? Yeah, kind of thing. But anyway, it's a story of crazy. Alcohol, and untreated alcoholism has a whole dimension of living that normal people have no idea what's going on. And we could probably try to convince them that it's cool, it's right, it's normal, right? So this day happened with them, and I was really mad at my kids because they were blaming me for the father leaving again. And his last comment to me that, like the night or two before, he threw a vase at me and I ducked. And he said, you know, you've really got to get a hold of yourself. And internally, you got to get a grip. And he was absolutely right, although I returned the vase throwing with something else and he split. And He came to pick him up that Saturday morning. No, it was a Friday morning. He came to pick him up, and they sat on the steps for 7.5 hours waiting for their father to show up. They wouldn't let me help them. I just was watching the pain in their faces about the lifestyle I had now really put my kids through. And I'm like, this is exactly how I grew up. I'm doing them exactly what was done to me. I can't even believe it. I couldn't believe it, that alcohol, and all I wanted to do was drink. So they left, and I had gotten stuck together because that was the last day of my life, or so I thought. And I started to thought in my mind, a thought not from me in my mind comes around and says, you know, what will they do? Stuck with him? Who's going to help them? And so when I had left the therapist, she had given me information to call detox at a local hospital, and I called. And the woman who answered said to me, well, you might want to come and check yourself in, how much you're drinking, you really can't detox on your own, alcohol, you can go to seizures, blah, blah, blah. I didn't hear blah, 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 kind of talk on the other end. And I just told her that, well, I can't. What would the neighbors think? Oh, my God. What would the neighbors think? Like they didn't know. And so I decided to go see her, and I was really drunk. But I drove down anyway to this hospital in my area, detox, and she came downstairs, and she came downstairs with a meeting book. And she said, listen, if you won't check yourself in here, perhaps you'd consider, that's all she asked me, perhaps you'd consider going to a meeting. And she sat down and she explained a little bit about what I would probably find there, who I would probably find there, and perhaps maybe I could relate there. So I took the meeting book, and she circled 3 meetings, and she said, but do me a favor, can you do this? You have alcohol in your house. I said, I do. She said, do you think you can throw it away? And I said, I think I can. And then she said, do you have anything else in your house? I said, I absolutely do. Do you think you can get rid of it? I said, I absolutely can. And I had no intention of doing any of it. And I get home, and the first thing I do is I pour the stuff. I had now only resorted to rocket juice, which is a fancy word for wine, because it's the only thing I could drink that would stay down, and I had various of sundry other items, and I got rid of everything. And I was the kind of person who couldn't sleep through the night. I would go to sleep when the birds woke up because it was light outside, and you can't attack me if it's light outside. You know, terrorizing stuff that is an experience of untreated alcoholism and the choices I made. So a very interesting thing happened. I woke up that morning and my kids were with him, and I was like, I had no desire to drink. I couldn't believe it. And I went and checked out where that meeting room was. You know, I got over there and I checked out the meeting room, so I at least I knew where I was going. And I'm really kind of an on-time kind of person. I really like being 15 minutes early and anywhere I go. Oh, this is the reason. So I can scope it out, so I can make sure I'm safe. That habit really hasn't left much. So I go to this meeting, and I check out the other two that she suggests, and I come back to this place in Denville, New Jersey, and it's probably one of the few places that you would call, you know, a meeting place where they have lots of meetings in that place that they usually don't, there are not too many of them in North Jersey. Kind of like a clubhouse, but not really, it's just one room. So I wait, and I'm watching you. And I watched a guy pulled up, and he opened the door, and he's standing outside, and he's greeting people. I don't know that's what they're doing yet. They're greeting people, and, you know, and so I go in, and I'm 20 minutes early. And he looked at me, and he said, are you new here? And I'm like, shoot, how did they know? And I said, yes, absolutely. And he said, well, welcome. He took my hand. So, you know, greeters are the most important position for a newcomer like me. I don't know if anyone hadn't greeted me if I would have walked in that room. It would have been a little too scary. He took my hand in his very warm hand, and he said, welcome home. And he said, inside there is some coffee if you'd like some. Just take a seat. Okay. So I go inside and meet this woman at the coffee pot, and she is still in my network today. And Kathleen hands me a cup of coffee, half a cup. How do you know? You're shaking like a leaf, right? And she sits down, and then you start to come in, and like the coffee started to fill the room. And I need to describe to you what has kept me in Alcoholics Anonymous since that day. The smell of the coffee started to fill the room, and you started to walk in, and the energy shifted. It shifted from an empty, cold room to this feeling that I hadn't had since I was like 8, that I had been seeking since I was about 8, that I found in a Catholic church when I was a little kid, and it was the same kind of feeling. And I know today that that's because God arrives. At some point, and I felt that, I'm not kidding, I was like, what is this? I want more of the safe and protected. I hadn't been safe and protected since about 8 years old when the first level of abuse started in my life. To the locked in the basement, all that stuff that comes along with where we come from. I hadn't been safe and protected like the feeling I had in that first meeting. And so I'm watching the group and I'm watching you, is what I'm doing. I'm watching you and I'm like, these are not what I thought alcoholics looked like. And this is not at all what I thought I was going to walk into. You know, I have a story playing in my head about what I would find here. And it is not the story that I found here. What I have found here is incredible. But in the corner of this room, there was a woman and she had a lot of people around her and they were really laughing. And I thought for the first time, I don't know how to do that. I do not know how to laugh. I do not know how to even be comfortable with people around me. And I certainly didn't think I could do any of this sober without a drink. So after the meeting, and the meeting was a great 5 meeting, and they talked about a power greater than yourself. And I didn't have a problem with God. God's always been cool in my life. I just didn't have a relationship with God, and I knew I was going to hell with what I did. So, you know, it's no big deal. I just didn't fit the criteria of going to heaven with what I was doing. And I come to find out from that article that they were reading that isn't the God they're talking about. A little confusing. Okay, well, whatever. It's like, whatever. You know, kind of like whatever. And these people come up to me afterwards. This woman, her name is Karen, she came up to me afterwards and she said, so where are you going tomorrow? And I said, I don't know. And she said, well, we'll be right here at 7 o'clock tomorrow night. Why don't you come on back? And I did. And there started a journey that I thank God for that greater. And the suggestion that 12-stepper who sat at that hospital, or maybe it was the fact the idea came to mind with the therapist. I really don't know who my first 12-stepper was. To bring me to AA so AA could bring me to God. And could bring me to a life that I didn't know would be possible for a person like myself. So it started on a journey, and it started little by slowly, and I had no idea what was going to be in front of you. So I don't know what the sobriety here is in your group. I know some people. I don't know if you're brand new. I don't know if you've been around for a while. I don't know if you're slip-sliding around. I have no idea. But I can tell you this. That we get a reset every day to find a new way. And I'm going to talk about that a little bit. So I started going to this meeting at Union Hill. And they had different meetings, different things. And I had the sponsor. And this woman was a teacher. She had no children. She had no idea about being married, being left, being cheated on, being betrayed. She had none of that. She comes from a really healthy, happy family. She was the only drunk in the family. You know, she was financially fine. I was like, what is that? I can't even balance a checkbook. One won't have a checkbook. Maybe I should tell her that first. She doesn't know about scamming and cheating for food. She doesn't know about all the things that I was doing in order to be. She doesn't have an idea. But she does. She knows all about me because I'm an alcoholic but her. She knows how I think. And so anyway, she said to me, meet me at my apartment on this Tuesday night. And I did. I went over to her apartment and she said, oh, and bring your self-help books. Okay. So I had this big shopping bag full of self-help books and she took them and she said, you've helped yourself quite a lot. So she hands me back a big book, a 12 of 12 and a women's meditation book. And she said, this is what we'll be reading. And she introduced me, she sat down, she qualified me, and she said, why do I think then I am an alcoholic? She asked me about my drinking, she asked me how I drank. She qualified me just like they do in our book. She taught me to do that and the same for others. She qualified me, and then we started on this this path. She asked me all these questions about, and no one ever asked me questions like that. No one ever asked me how I drank and about why I was drinking. She didn't. She asked me what happened when I took a drink and the drink took you. She asked me about how I felt, the remorse. She had talked about the remorse, the shame and the guilt and the remorse after a spree. That's not how she worded it, but that's what she was doing. And I'm crying, and for the first time she looks over at me, and tears in her eyes, she said, listen, I said, let me tell you, that if you just do the things that we do, you will not believe the woman you'll become. You'll knock your socks off. And I was like, yeah, right. I didn't believe her words, but I believed her eyes. You know, when I think about that, when we read in Bill's story, you know, and this is the greatest love story in the world, you know, our big book. That he saw it in his eyes, that he was telling the truth, so I knew she was telling the truth. So I just started to do what you did. And I would go to these meetings, and she would say, you need a position, and I'd go, okay, what does that mean? So she made me the greeter, and you had to shake hands, and I had a hard time with that. So then things moved on, and she took me through the big book of Alcoholics Anonymous. And the 12 and 12, and in 1989, that's not how they went through the work. It was mainly 12 and 12. It was not what we do today. And I was in a pocket of enthusiasm in North Jersey that was following Joe and Charlie. And I was 3 weeks sober, and they take me to Joe and Charlie workshop in Parsippany, New Jersey. And I walk into all of you with the books and the highlighters and the energy, and I'm like, oh my God. And I had no idea. I was still stuttering. I couldn't think. I was like, I just felt the power, the energy. That's what kept me coming and still keeps me coming, by the way. You know, and I get with the stuff on the wall and all that, but my launching into the big book came in Joe and Charlie workbook workshop, and I remember them sitting up front, and I remember Joe and Charlie just facing the crowd and talking about things that I always felt but could never articulate. And how that this book had the solution for everything. And they had introduced, they were with another woman, her name is Willie D. And she was like, they would do a 12, and they would do the step out of the big book, and she would do the step out of the 12 and 12. And they would go back and forth doing this. It was the most incredible thing. I don't remember a whole lot. I had to go back and get, they were tapes then, the tapes in order to hear it eventually as it could seep in. But I have to tell you, I sponsor the same way today, using both. And I was catapulted into a new way of living. I didn't even know that's what it was called. But I suddenly realized. I went from that to the area convention. The area convention, they put on one of those things that says greeter, and I went, no way. And I stood by the door. And I learned how to shake your hand and know that you weren't going to harm me. And my sponsor put spies on me so I wouldn't split, you know. So that was good because I probably would have left. And then they bring me into these big rooms, and there was a speaker there. And if a speaker that you hear at a conference or coming to your home group or at a speaker meeting tells your story one day, you just know it. And this woman told my story. Her name was Beth G, and she was from Brecksville, Ohio. And she told me about the loneliness. She identified with drinking with your children in your care. She identified with family walking out on you. She was funny. She talked about spraying her wine bottles white and hanging them out the window so they matched the building and stuff like that. But what happened in that whole story was an identification of, I feel exactly like she feels. And it was amazing to me that I wasn't unique. I was no longer unique in this process. There was somebody just like me who was there. And that conference was about 5,000 people go to that thing. And there was a gentleman there, and I was walking out of the meeting, and I used to suffer from panic attacks like you wouldn't believe. He walks over and he starts talking about his panic attacks. Because here you'll find that there's people just like you. And that's what happened to me. And I joined that home group, that first home group, and I got a commitment there, and I started to get involved in Alcoholics Anonymous. My sponsor was real involved in history, so she took me up to Stepping Stones. We went out to Akron. We went into GSO. I got familiar with the real. And being in the footprint of Alcoholics Anonymous, you know, we visited places in Montclair. We went to the old home group meetings. And I can tell you this, that I began to have a feeling that I was a part of something at last. Finally, a part of something at last. Like you couldn't kick me out and tell me not to come again. And that began a journey into doing just this kind of stuff. And fellowship will keep you. I was doing the deal, so I thought. I was doing the deal, and 3-4 years into the work, my, I'm still separated from my husband, and he's not paying for anything, and lots of stuff is going on with that, and I don't know how I'm going to pass the next day. I lost my business because of my drinking. I was losing my business. I didn't have the money. You know, that kind of stuff happens to people like you and me. And little by little, the miracles show up, right? Get a job here, a job there, and I can pay my rent and do this kind of stuff. And I'm like one step in front of being evicted, and things are starting to move in a little different direction, and my son gets sick. And he comes home one day. He's an incredibly talented athlete, and as a freshman in high school, he was the quarterback for the varsity team, on their football team. And he comes in and he's not feeling so hot, and I suspected it for like 6 months, but doctors usually treat lunatic mothers like me as not knowing anything. So, it turns out that he's in complete renal failure and needs a transplant. And from a virus. And my husband's MIA, I have no idea what to do. We start the process, and 6 months later, we have this miracle, and he's transplanted, and he can live a life. And little by little, the people show up. A year later, my mom dies from a heart attack. I mean, it just keeps happening. And Alcoholics Anonymous keeps showing up. Like, Alcoholics Anonymous walks in with 3 pots of coffee, all these supplies, and my family walks in with 12 boxes of booze. You know, and months before, I had taken a commitment to speak for Alcoholics Anonymous, and it was like I could leave there. You know, and so, if you believe there's a solution for you, there will be. If I believe there's no solution for me, there won't be. And it all does go back to that step two. I came to believe in a power that's greater than me, that's going to bring me to a solution that I don't even think I need, by the way. You know, and that's a little bit what started to happen. And life is taking another course, right? I end up getting back with that guy after all of my ex-husband again. I've been through a lot of counseling by this time and a lot of sponsor advice, like, don't do that. And of course, who knows about sex and checks better than me? And I'm 12 years sober. And I got a secret going on from you. And I got, and the secret that's going on from you is that I am seeing him. And, because I want to. And there's no other explanation. All of the evidence of the world would not have stopped me. I have the evidence. It's written in several 4 steps. The evidence of the life with an untreated alcoholic. The evidence of my life as an untreated alcoholic. So I'm not drinking, but I'm cheating. And I'm cheating on Alcoholics Anonymous, so I'm not being honest. So I have this experience with my God, you know, into two-way prayer. I have done many 4 steps, 5 steps, sponsoring people. I'm chairing retreats. I'm all over Alcoholics Anonymous in North Jersey. I'm doing all kinds of stuff, but I've got a secret. And I'm not telling anybody. And I have this thought come through my head. You know how that happens, that this thought just comes? It holds you tight. And this thought just comes right through my head, and it says, you know what? I want all of you. And I went, God, you can't have that. I just knew. That's where it was coming from. It was like I'm withholding and I know it. And sure enough, the next day I have a situation occur and I ended up in the battered women's shelter. I'm 12 years sober. Now I have to go back to my home group and tell them I'm at the battered woman shelter. I was there for 6 weeks. And terror had ensued, and my daughter, my youngest daughter, was with me, and she looked at me, and she said this. She said, "Mom, when are you going to protect me from this?" Here all along, I had no idea of the damage of that continual lifestyle was doing to her and my other two kids. So it was there, a decision. I made the decision, and I knew that decision was going to be costly. I knew it was going to be something, because there's a lot of shenanigans that are going on behind the scenes, and I'm going to call it that because I'm at a podium. So we'll call it shenanigans. There's a lot of stuff going on, and it's not the truth. So we end up in a situation that is absolutely crazy. He was fired from his job in New York, and he was fired for a whole lot of reasons, and he decides he's never going to work again. It's my turn to pay the mortgage. And I'm like, what? And in the meantime, he'd been cashing in gambling and drugs. Okay, so you can only imagine what happened to all of this money I thought we had. So on that one, the IRS appears at my door. And the IRS appears at my door with an eviction notice. They already closed all my bank accounts, took the cars away, and I had 30 days to vacate my house because they were taking it for in debt $500,000. So what do? I'm a good AA. I've got 4 meetings a week, you know, early in sobriety. My sponsor said, "You'll have a speaker meeting at 12 and 12, a big book, and a women's discussion meeting because you love men too much." So those were my meetings, my mandatory meetings, and they had to be the same place every week. They couldn't be in a variety of places, which is what I preferred. No, and I had to report in every Tuesday. I had to have a service commitment in Alcoholics Anonymous. I was sponsoring women, or she would sponsor me, and I was terrified of being fired. I did all of what she told me to do. And I still do that today. I've got something, always. Speaking commitment once a month. "What are you doing here? What are you doing here?" And I was like, okay, I'm doing it. I go to an AA meeting. I mean, just short of the miracles that happen to people like you and me that I don't think I ever deserved, but God obviously saw fit. I'm sitting and I walk into this meeting and there's my friend Kathleen and she's like, "Oh my God, what happened?" And I was like, "Look, I am really resourceful. One thing alcoholics are, and we're resourceful. But we might be on verging on manipulating, but we're very resourceful. We can really get things done no one else can get done when we put our minds to it." So I said, "I don't know how I'm going to do this." And there was a guy sitting next to me, never saw him before, ever. He's sitting next to me and he's hearing me talk to Kathleen. And I was really quiet because I had no idea what to do. And he leans over, taps me on the shoulder, and he says this. He said, "You know, I'm sorry to eavesdrop, but I'm an ex-IRS agent. I think I can help you." And he does. And we're able to not finagle, legally correct the situation to that only old half of that. But we were able to do that. And I stood there in amazement, as I often do, when God shows up when I can't, through you, because my God always shows up in skin. Shows up to me to tell me, "I got this. I got this. I got this. Why don't you believe me?" You know, we made a decision in step 3. I came to believe in step 2 that a power greater than me was going to bring me to that decision. I made a decision to turn my will and my life over to the care of something. And it was something greater than me. And in that decision, in that little short decision, I was given that third step prayer to hold me tight no matter what happened, wherever it happened, no matter what, that I could take every anxiety that's bumping against my character defenses, my defects of character, and I can have God give me a shot, give me the strength to do the next right thing. You know, there's some things you have to do after that, but for the most part, every time, it works every time. And I sit in amazement every time how much that works. So that happened, and shortly thereafter I was offered an unbelievable job, cutting salary, and it was mostly commissions, and I made back in a year all the commissions in the world to pay that IRS debt and have to go bankrupt. Then I bought another house, and I got my kids to school, and got them married, and I had 9 grandsons. Did you hear sons? No daughters. No polka dots yet. And I get introduced to you, and I get introduced to a whole bunch of different things. And at that time, when I entered into that God wants everything deal, I needed a new sponsor and I needed a new experience. And I had been actually stalking my sponsor I have today. I was stalking her. And so but she travels all over the place. So I mean, I found her, had a great conversation with her. And she introduced me to the article Bill Wilson wrote on emotional sobriety. And she told me that that place that I had hit was a place where God needs me. That's a place that I needed to take and go in depth into those steps in a totally different way. Something totally unfamiliar to me. I had done the surface work. I'm physically sober. I haven't had a drink since the day September 6, 1989. No desire to have a drink, but I had done a lot of other crazy stuff. A lot of other crazy stuff, and those things needed to be worked through. So there was I just grabbed this, I don't know why this morning, I guess it was because I wanted to share it with you. That there's a line in there that caught me up, that really led to me going deep into relationship with the power through the steps, into emotional sobriety. And that has led me into the most incredible life I have. Because I've not only found the promise they gave us, which was peace of mind, I have found peace of soul. And I have found it. And I didn't have to do anything. I didn't do it. God did it. It was like delivered. You know, they talk about being delivered. They talk about the transformation of heart and mind and soul. That's all talked about in our book. Well, it's for real. You know, and in this article, I don't know if you ever had an opportunity to read it. He wrote here that if we examine every disturbance we have, great or small, we can find an unhealthy dependency underlying it. At its root, an unhealthy dependency. That means that I'm relying on you for my everyday living. I'm relying on you to give me applause and not relying on the power who with me gets that applause. You know, it's like incredible. So it took me through a whole new change that I can take this statement because this rooted dependency is unhealthy, number one, and just leads to building up self, which is what our whole step work is trying to help us not do. So the other thing it says, and it's consequent demand. They say it's a hobbling demand. And I think about the outside influences in my life, how I relied on other people, places, and things to define who I am. And it took me till this experience to realize that I'm not who you say I am. I am who God says I am. And I'm sober today. And I can come into anywhere and be who I am, even if they don't like me. And that used to be really important. That everyone likes me. Or even if we think differently, I can honor that difference of opinion with you and know that, okay, I can stay or I can go. And not even do it without disturbance, you know what I mean? So what's led in the years after that? Okay, so you're talking, you know, at least 20, 30 years later, I have been able to travel with Alcoholics Anonymous. I can go anywhere, and I usually find AA is everywhere, but going through these conferences and meeting these people, I have found that I like being with my people. I like being with those people in that third step decision to turn my will and my life over to the care of God and live in 10 and 11, being accountable for my thinking, paying attention to what's going on in the course of the day. I can see when my ego's rebuilding and I need to like step back and say, whoa, what am I doing? Because the last thing I want to do today is pick up a drink or a drug. The very last thing I want to do today is harm you in any way. The very last thing I want to do is become the disrespectful, grandiose personality I had to be when I got here. That's not who I want to be. And, you know, recently, it was like right after COVID ended, I was up at the Wilson House, and I had an opportunity to do service up there quite a bit. So I don't know if you've ever been there, but right near the Wilson House in Vermont is the graveyard. And in the graveyard, that's where Bill and Lois are buried, and it's so much like a pauper's grave. And I was thinking about the greatness of his life, that You know, he liked the applause. He liked the attention. And then on the flip side, we'd been at Akron, and I see where Dr. Bob is buried. And that's real grandiose. It's beautiful. It's a big, huge marble thing, you know, monument. And now he's got the Four Absolutes on the other side, and people come from all over to see both of these places. And I thought to myself, look at this, the transformation that occurs. Bob became exactly who he was meant to be, and he liked to be the quiet guy behind the scenes. You know, and Bill, who was that boisterous person in real life, becomes a soldier for us. And I just find out that with God's help, I can surrender these hobbling demands. I can surrender the arrogance, the grandiosity, the things that plague my personality on a daily walk. Because those defenses, those defects, they get activated and drop a hat. But I have tools today so that I don't harm you, I don't harm me, and I can be a demonstration of the love that God has for all of us. And I think I'm out of time. So thank you so much for having me.
You can sit.
Okay, thank you.
Thank you very much.
Okay, the group would also like to remind anyone in need of a sponsor, please see somebody after the meeting. We have that piece of that open, sorry. Please see somebody after the meeting. When anybody has working knowledge of the 12 step, please raise your hands. Thank you. The group would like to thank Karen again for coming up.